Hello and welcome to the West City Church podcast. If you'd like to get to know us more, find us at westcitychurch.com.au. We really hope that you're encouraged by today's message.
Potter number one, or two, because I'm married. Because I've got the microphone, I can say what I want. Before doing communion, I just wanted to thank Zach and Aaron for all their service and all their love and generosity that they've provided this church. It's a real shame that they're leaving, but I'm so lucky I get to see them at home church, so haha. I just wanted to pray for them. Just to say thank you for everything they do for this church and the joy and love they bring and bring towards everyone here. Aaron obviously does a lot in the service, and I think watching Zach every week brings joy to all of us. So if we can all just bow our heads and pray, that would be great. Father, I just want to thank you for Aaron and Zach and everything they do. I pray that going into this new year in a new church journey or a church hopping, finding what suits them and suits what they need and what you can give them, that you'll just bless them and carry them on. But they'll know that they'll always have a home at West City. Thank you. Amen. Alrighty, now to my communion talk. So my faith began when I was 12 at a Pentecostal church via going to youth group. And I stayed Penty up until I came to West City in around 2018. As I've grown older and come to West City and learnt more about Jesus, I've reflected on my experience and upbringing as Pentecostal. And through that reflections, there's a lot of beliefs and practices I absolutely love and that I, you know, am so, so grateful for. I do think we need more clapping at West City, to be fair. thank you. Some practices that I'm very happy to leave behind in the Penty space, and others that I completely reject for being incongruent with the image of Jesus. One thing that I've reflected on is how every Sunday there would be a 10-minute message on tithes and offerings, but we would only do a 5-minute communion message once a month. These tithing messages would often involve things which are frankly manipulative. If you don't tithe, you don't have proper faith. If you do tithe, God will look at you with favour. How much you give is an expression of your faith. If you give, you will certainly get tenfold back. These are all things which I frankly reject completely. God's love is 100% unconditional, and there is no way we can earn this or lose this by giving money. The starkness of these messages, in parallel with taking communion only once a month, and certainly not with as much thought and intention as tithing, muddled my understanding of what communion is and warped how I view generosity. I believe communion is the act of joining a community together, acknowledging Jesus' sacrifice and his unconditional love to all. But I grew up believing and being taught that communion was not as important as tithing, and that you would garner more favour with God if you gave to the church. So as my faith and relearning grew and I rejected these messages behind tithing, I ended up rejecting giving completely. I know we are still called to be generous, so I would give to charities and be generous with friends and family, but the idea of giving to church felt like I was accepting those messages that I was being told. However, in the last year or so, my reflection has allowed me to realise that giving to church, and for us, West City, is purely allowing the communion table to exist in a practical setting. Without funds, the church can't pay for the bills, the electricity, pay the well-deserved wages of the staff, and can't support the community when needed or put on events like Carols in the Car Park. Where I previously believed that giving was a way to earn a place at the table and God's love, I now believe that tithing establishes the groundwork for the community that we celebrate when we take communion. Now, I know this has seemed more like a tithing talk than a communion talk, and that was not intentional with what Aaron said before, but I hope it has come across that my past has caused these to be inherently linked. But what I want to change for those of you who may have similar experiences or thoughts is that tithing can be a positive experience that gives back to our community and should not be viewed as a way to earn a place at the communion table. These have just been my reflections in the past year or so, and if it's also something you have been on the fence about, I would strongly encourage you to consider making offering a regular practice in the new year. So while we take the bread and the wine or juice, Let's appreciate God's love and sacrifice that is unconditional and be grateful that West City is able to be the vessel for us to take communion and spend this time together as a community.
Thanks. Morning. Hello, I'm on. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to everyone. Let me just get comfy here. And my slides, I think my slides are on. Is that, if I press that, is that on? Yeah, sweet. All right, lovely. Let me pull up my notes here as well. Sorry, one second. I don't know about y'all, I'm super excited this morning. One reason I'm super excited is because usually when you preach, there's like set themes or topics, or you get given a message, like a verse or whatever to use. But I do not have any of that because it's December 31st, so there's no sermon themes or topics or anything. I just get to go for my life and reign in the new year, which is awesome, so I'm excited. I also don't know about any of you, but I've had a really good Christmas break. I'm one of those ones that, you know, finished work Friday, you know, a couple of weeks ago or whatever, and I don't have to think about work again until Monday the 8th, so I'm vibing right now, you know. I don't have to work, so I'm good. And I'm super excited. What I want to do this morning, obviously, like I said, there's no sort of set theme or topic or anything like that. Those that know West City and the way we do things, we actually start our year with homebrew, they call it. So over the next sort of 4 weeks, we're going to hear from various people from our community, which is going to be awesome. And I'm going to sort of treat this morning a little bit of a homebrew. Like, I want to be able to, I know I've spoken maybe a couple of times, you guys have heard from me once or twice before. I want to sort of share a bit just about myself and especially my year, and then sort of go from there and see how we go. So before I do any of that, I will still be talking about the Bible. I won't just be talking about myself. And really, I'm going to actually, and I'll read it now, Psalm 8. This is really the psalm that I want us to reflect on, I guess. And it's a psalm that's sort of not necessarily that I've like reread and read and it's been like in my brain throughout the whole year, but it's just a psalm that every time I read it and come back to it, it invokes just everything from the Bible comes together for me in this psalm in such a special way. So it has sort of in that way just carried me through the year. Let me read, and then I've got a whole bunch of photos and things I'm going to show you about my year, and then we can talk some more about this psalm. So this is Psalm 8. I'm going to read. Yahweh, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory in the heavens. Through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the works of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings, that you care for them. You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds, the animals of the wild, the birds in the sky and the fish of the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas. Yahweh, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. Psalm 8. So before we start reflecting on that, I mean, there's heaps in that psalm. You could just literally take that away and read it, reread it, and just go for your life with it. I'm going to try and bring out some things. I don't even know what yet fully, but I've got some stuff. But before we do that, I just want to reflect on my year, what it means to be human, my year. And so I've got some photos and things. Firstly, I've got data. Like, you guys know the Spotify Wrapped, right? So Spotify Wrapped is beautiful data that comes out. I've also wear this watch. So this thing, like, records when I sleep and, like, my stress levels and things. I don't even know how to fully read it. Sometimes I just sort of look at, like, hours slept and I'm just like, forget about that. But it actually did. So I basically wake up super early. Apparently on average, yeah, so I took that photo because that's basically my life at home. I have to try and squeeze either, you know, between one of the two gaps that are there on the couch. And that's pretty much what our life looks like at home. According to the watch, you know, I'm basically in bed by 9. That's not even a lie. I reckon like 8:30 p.m. at night, you're going to catch me in my bed already. But by about 4:30 in the morning, I'm usually sort of up and about and doing stuff. So you know, that's me. That's my sleep pattern for y'all, for the year. Like I said, Spotify Wrapped. So if you're going to catch me on any given day, this is sort of my life. Kings of Leon is my favourite band, I would say, of all time. So it kind of makes sense that they're up there as my yeah, Bitter Belief. Most of you won't know who that is. He's actually a Perth guy named Aaron. He's a rapper, and I love his music. So I actually versed him at basketball a bunch because he used to play, lived in Currumbine. But he's awesome. Eminem still made it. That's like pastime. He's just must be full of my playlist, and he somehow made the cut. So can't run away from it because it is what it is. It's what I've listened to in the year, apparently. Podcast-wise, like, you're going to catch me on any given day. I'm a big Bible Project guy. I love the Bible Project. I've listened to a lot of the Bible Project. 0.5% fan, apparently, because I've listened to a whole lot of their stuff. Those other couple, like John Mark Comer. Does anyone know John Mark Comer? No. Yeah? Oh, there we go. Look at that. He's awesome. Anyone that wants to just listen to some sermons, he's a great preacher. He's got a lot of good stuff on psychology and just biblical teaching and all that sort of stuff. N.T. Wright, who doesn't love N.T. Wright. The bottom one's basically the Bible Project guy, but that fourth one, anyone listen to that one? How Are the Dad's Dad? Yeah, come on. Dude, you guys need to get into it. That's Hamish Blake. That's an awesome podcast. My wife actually made me listen to it. We don't have kids yet, so I'm not a dad, but she sort of said, unless you listen to this, like, I'm not going to let you be a dad sort of thing. So I had to listen to that. But it's awesome. I highly recommend. He's got like 2 seasons out. And it's Hamish Blake, Hamish and Andy, and he hosts a bunch of people that just come on and talk parenthood and like fathering and stuff like that, and it is phenomenal. So that's me. I'm up early. I go to bed early. I listen to these things. That's those songs. So literally, like, that's my top like songs, and like Billy Joel, Ray Charles. Literally, Ray Charles would be in my car on the way to work. Bare Necessities is whatever number that is, 7 or whatever. Like, on any given morning, I'm probably rocking the Bare Necessities on the way to work, and not even ashamed of it. I will belt it out. Mahalia loves it. She's good. And I had to put Leaving Zanzibar there because it's it hit like top 15, and that thing's only been out for like a month. Marksman Lloyd released it like about a month ago or so, and cracked my top 15 already because I love it. So that's my music, that's my sleep pattern, that's my year, that's what it looked like. A lot of the stuff that I do, I'm pretty sporty, so I play footy for the Savannah's Tiger Sharks, which is like 2 hours north in Savannah. So this year we actually had the pleasure of hitting a kangaroo in the work car, which was fun. I had my brother and a couple other boys in the car, and it was, you know, going 110, bang, it was very good. the airbags went off and everything. I lost my car for like 2 months while I got repaired. But it's every Saturday. I drive a couple hours, play country footy. We train on Wednesday nights. I also play basketball. So this is an old photo because we won last season and then took that photo and then we moved up a grade and then we won again. And I didn't get the photo from a couple weeks ago, but we just won our grand final. I don't know if anyone knows any of the people in that picture, but there's some names. There's Ross Hack in the middle. A couple of the other boys there are from Christian City Church in Joondalup. Who I just met through basketball, actually, and play basketball with them. There's tennis there on the side because Mahalia and I have recently got into tennis. So we call ourselves tennis stars now. We had like 8 lessons, so we're good. We're ready to roll. Other than that, that's pretty much my general like day to day, right? So I go to bed early, I get up early. I mean, I work Monday to Friday. I'm a manager at work, so that's my life, like 10 hours of every day of Monday to Friday, I'm working. But when I'm not working, I'm playing basketball, playing tennis, or listening to Ray Charles or the Bare Necessities in the car. That's basically me. I have had a pretty exciting year, though. We've actually gone on like 3 different holidays. So back in March, my brother turned 18, my younger brother. We went to Bali, which is awesome, just lots of holidaying and reading. That bottom right photo is my older brother Matt, and it basically describes all of us. It's out of order and under maintenance, and he took that photo, and yep, that was us, out of order and under maintenance. So that was Bali. We went to Bali in March. We actually went to KL in whenever we did, June? I don't even know. Wife doesn't. June? I'm getting the nod. June, we went to KL. Got to see, again, just whole different, like, this was a bird park we went to. little coffee store. What does it say? Can anyone read it? It's don't tell them your plans, show them your results. I think that's what it says on that cup. We loved it. KL is awesome. There's like so many activities. This was like a shopping center and we did archery and got splattered with paint. This place was awesome. Caves, this massive statue. The staircase is hell. You've got to walk up the staircase. It's a long staircase and it's very steep. But you get to see some monkeys. So there was all these, the Batu caves, little monkeys. Bali, KL, and then lastly, we went more recently. Obviously, there was church camp. Straight after church camp down in Boston, Mahalia and I stayed in Bunker Bay as well for a few days. So just glorious. That was only a couple months ago or whatever. That was amazing. The weather was amazing. Coming off the back of church camp as well, it was either beer or coffee or reading or something. Church camp. This was church camp. Love it. So this is basically my year. This is what my life looks like. This is what the year looks like for West City. I also want to just, this is our man Jackson. I snagged this photo a long time ago. He doesn't even know. And I actually have a video, but I didn't want to try and complicate things with showing a video. But I got some videos from church camp as well, which are actually unforeseen footage. I didn't actually send it through for the thing. So I've got some of Zach rapping and things like this, which are awesome. But it's all right. We won't have to go into it. So, like I said, homebrew. This is basically I just wanted to share briefly, I guess, a snapshot of my year and my life, I guess, in general, and what it's looked like. Obviously, personally, you've seen I'm up early, I go to bed early, I work most of the time, I'm pretty sporty. But outside of that, this year in particular at West City has been a really phenomenal year. Mahalia and I both have just enjoyed this year more so than any other year. We've sort of decided to commit a little bit more, just see where we can serve and help, be more involved. The reason I've got Jackson up there, by the way, is we actually sort of part of Jackson's home church. So he's a legend. He hosts us every other Tuesday or whatever. So if it's not Tuesday night at Jackson's, it's Wednesday at basketball or footy or Saturday at footy or I'm just working and that's pretty much me. Or listening to Bare Necessities and that sort of thing. So I don't know how your years have gone. I'm pretty lucky. I've had a pretty good year. I don't think I've had too much that I have to reflect on that's been too hard, in all honesty. But that's okay. It's not to say that we can't deal with hard things. It's not to say that you're not still important if you deal with hard things. What I want to talk about this morning, though, Psalm 8, and really what it means to be human. What is mankind that God is mindful of us? Who am I that lived this year that got to experience the things that I got to experience? That's really what this psalm sort of gets me into the mindset of thinking. Particularly on, obviously, this is the last day of the year. This is the day where you sort of step back, you reflect on the year, you look at the next year. This psalm is sort of one of those psalms that looks back, but real big lens. It looks right at the stars, the moon, the skies, and it sort of steps back to go, not for the purpose of getting lost in the vastness of, the nothingness, but for the purpose of realizing that out of that vastness, here we are. Here I am with what I'm going through and what I need to deal with. And who am I that God would be mindful of me? That's really the sun. It's asking in the sense of who is human beings in general. But then you dig deeper and you're who am I? Why would God incline his ear towards me? Why would he look towards me with any kind of favor? This psalm, and I'll just go back to it. I won't reread a lot of it, but I think just from hearing it, the works of his fingers, the moons and the stars, which he set in place, that he put us as rulers over the works of his hands. When you read this psalm, whoever wrote this psalm clearly has reflected a lot on Genesis, particularly the creation accounts. The phrasings, the words and all that sort of thing, it's almost identical. It's like he's read Genesis 1 and 2 and then the rest of Genesis, and he's really trying to contemplate, who am I to be put here as this human being, and what am I meant to be doing? So what I want to do is go back just to Genesis and sort of look at a couple of those phrases. So Genesis 1 and 2, so two creation accounts, so two different versions, in a sense. So in Genesis 1, this is a little poem that it reads, "So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, 'Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea, birds in the sky, and over every living creature that moves on the ground.'" So that's the picture we get in Genesis 1. Then he plants a garden in Genesis 2 of Eden. So in Genesis 2:15, the Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. So when you read, I mean, we're not going to read the full accounts, but if you go and read Genesis 1 and 2, these are sort of some of the phrases that stick out to you in terms of what is mankind? What is human? What are we set here to do? What is our purpose? What is our calling? Why us? You know, why are we different? This sort of is trying to scratch that itch, these creation accounts. And not even just scratch the itch, but like if you go back, so those phrases that you see there, that image of God phrase, that's a huge phrase. For an ancient culture to write a creation account and state that all human beings across the board are the image of God, that's like a subversive, revolutionary statement. So in the ancient world, the image of God was the king. It wasn't just like everyone was the image of God. There would be like the Pharaoh and he's the image of God and we would look to him and worship him. The rest of us will be just like the peasants, like the humans, you know, those lowly other creatures. And this creation account just starkly confronts that in the face and says, no, like every human being is the image of God. It's not even by virtue of something they do. It's just what you are. You are the image of God. So this is king language. Like, this is royal language. You are the word is rule. Like, rule the earth. We don't really use that, term anymore, I guess. We kind of used to, I think. When I was, like, younger, like, that rules. Like, you know, something was good. You'd be like, oh, that ruled. Like, that was awesome. But the actual, what it means is still present. That, like, these musicians up here, they ruled. Like, they ruled those instruments. They ruled it. They forced the notes and the chords to do what they wanted it to do, and they were able to come together and create this amazing sound. That's them ruling and subduing. So this isn't, you know, negative language. And I think this is the scary thing. Like, I want to continue to sort of harp on this point about being an image, being a human. It's like, you're powerful. You're a human being. And we get sort of antsy a little bit because we've seen what happens when humans are in power, but it's like not good. It doesn't look good. But that doesn't mean that humans shouldn't have power or don't have power. It just means that we have to be like really sensitive and cautious with the way that we use our power. The other phrase there, so we got obviously the image of God. It's a phrase, a huge phrase. You could talk about it for ages. Rule and subdue, again, it's this like royal subjects, you're these kings that are ruling the earth. That is the image. The other one in Genesis 2, the phrase work and keep, you're going to see these words come back up again in the Levitical texts and in Numbers. And it's the exact same phrase that they use for priests. So when the priests would be in the tabernacle, what they're doing is working the tabernacle. They're keeping it, they're tending it. So they had to constantly have their candles lit and they had to make sure that the candles didn't die down. You have to replace the wax. You got to replenish the bread. You know, you're working and keeping the temple, the tabernacle. You've got to maintain it. There's work to be done. These are the words that are used when God puts human on earth. He says, yeah, work and keep it. Like, maintain it. You're responsible for the creation that is at hand. Again, this is like powerful stuff. Humans are incredibly important creatures in the Bible. And in general, and again, I think because we've heard for so long that we're so important and we've seen such the negative impact of when people exalt themselves, we sometimes throw the baby out with the bathwater and think, well, you know, forget that, we're just these lowly human creatures or whatever. But no, you are still, even if you don't rule in a bad way, you are a ruler. you still hold that same credibility. You're still responsible with that same calling to be an image, to rule and subdue, to work and to keep. This is what humans are actually made for on this earth. Like I said, this psalmist, he would have read these passages. It's clear just from what he writes in the psalm. The phrases are the same, the words are the same. He's reflecting on the same concepts like this. What is human that, you know, you would set us to rule that all over all these animals, and you consider the vastness of everything that is, and then here we are with this calling to do something. I assume the psalmist has also read some of the other chapters of Genesis, which I'm just going to share a few verses just from the first 12 chapters, right? Which again just sort of unpacks this story of what is human? Well, like who is mankind that God would look on us? And I just want us to get a sense of the picture of like what a human being is according to Genesis 1 to 12. So we've already looked at you're an image of God, you rule, you are here to work and keep, to maintain God's good creation. So once they eat of the tree of knowing good and bad, which God told them not to do, the Lord God said, the man has now become like one of us, knowing good and bad. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. I'm just going to read them more and then we'll sort of talk about them. So and then in Genesis 4, this is Cain and Abel. Like just before Cain has confronted Abel and killed him, the Lord actually confronts Cain and he says, why are you angry? Why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it. And it's the exact same word. God tells Cain, like he warns him, there's something crouching at your door. You're about to do something that you really don't want to do and shouldn't do. Like God's trying to send him the warning. But he's also like commissioning him saying, you've got to rule over this thing. Like you're in control, man. Like you've got to take the power that I've given you and rule over this thing that's crouching at your door. Don't kill your brother. Obviously, that's not the story that plays out. But this is the commission that God gives him, right? Even though Cain didn't, you know, obey this, he didn't rule over sin. That's what God told him he was able to do and asked him to do. In Genesis 6, this one we really can't talk about because it's super big rabbit hole, but this is where the sons of God, like the Nephilim, mate with the humans and they create these like hybrid beings and things. Just worry about that another day. But after that happens, the Lord says, my spirit will not contend with humans forever. They are mortal. Their days will be 120. And it's like this marking point of like, I'm cutting it off at 120. You know what's crazy, actually? We came across this verse, my younger brother and I, by accident, because my younger brother asked, like, I wonder how old the like oldest person on earth is or whatever, and you Google, like, who are the oldest people to live? I think it was 121 was, like, the oldest person that had been recorded to exist. And then I was like, oh, funnily enough, Genesis 6 says this. Sorry, side note for that one. Genesis 12, last one. This is the Tower of Babel. So this is where they come together, they build the tower into the sky to exalt their own name, their own kingdom. The Lord comes down and sees the city and the tower that the people were building. The Lord said, if it's people speaking the same language, they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so that they will not understand each other. The picture I get when I read these verses in Genesis, right, and it almost sounds sacrilege to say, but it's like, has God met his match? Like, why is God, like, he's like, all right, if you're in this state where you've eaten of the tree of knowing good and bad, I can't have you live forever. You cannot eat of the tree of life, otherwise that will be real bad. You'll be on this course, like, for eternity, and we can't have that. So he exiles them from the garden. He still tells Cain, though, after he's been exiled, like, rule over sin. Like, it's okay. It's coming for you. I'm warning you of it, but you've got the power. You can do it. Rule over it. And then he even like, no, my spirit's not going to contend with humans. I'm going to cut their time short. And then confuses their language. It's like God has this knowledge that, man, if humans really figured it out and like started to really click and like unify themselves, nothing is impossible. And it is this sense of like, God's like, having to almost tame the fire a little bit, you know? Like, it's this human project thing might get out of control if it goes the wrong way. That's almost the sense that you get from these verses. And you certainly get the sense, I mean, God even himself says it, if they are unified in speech, like, nothing's impossible. They could just rule and subdue and they could achieve anything. That's God's vision of the human project and what we are capable of. Problem, I don't see many humans walking around ruling and subduing in the way that the Bible sort of depicts that they should. What we see is a lot of humans ruling and reigning, sometimes not so well. And I mean, I can just speak for my own life. Like, I know I rule and reign my life. I get to make decisions on what I eat and drink and what I do with my time and energies and things. And like, I'm not the best ruler of my own life even. And yet, like, God's put humans as rulers of creation. Like, I can't barely even rule my own life, God. You want me to rule creation? How the heck is that, like, going to work? And this is the story that I think the scriptures sort of set us up for. This is what Psalm 8 is sort of reflecting on, is like, humans are in this one stage, like, amazing, glorious creature. But then, like, in the riddle of the psalm, like, through the praise of infants and children, he's established his stronghold. It's almost reflecting on, like, yeah, human is this real powerful creature, but then, like, what is a human? It's this baby that is, like, helpless. Like, when he starts, it can't even fend for itself. It actually wouldn't even survive without the help of others. It needs to be comforted, needs to be fed. And it's almost like this psalmist is sort of looking at even a baby human and going, yeah, like, that's how God chooses to rule the world, is through that image. It's not some powerful, crazy, exertive king that's just going to do what needs to be done. It's like this babbling, crying infant, this helpless baby. That's how God chooses to actually reveal himself, show himself, to rule the world through helpless children. So this psalm, it sort of creates like this pocket, like, and even like the scriptures, Genesis from 1 to 12 and onwards, it's creating this category where, like, we need a true image of God. That's what we were created to do. That's what humans are. But you look around and I'm not seeing a whole lot of it, right? But this psalmist is like, yeah, but that's, it's like he's reflecting, going, that this is what humans are. He's not letting go of the hope that, no, we are the rulers. Like, we can do this thing. We just need a truly human one that can truly reign. Enter Jesus. like I said, with this psalm, this is why I love this psalm, because it's Psalm 8. It's like in the middle of the Bible. If I had a Bible, I'd show you. It's almost been the middle, right? And yet he's reflecting on Genesis 1 to 12 and onwards. But we're lucky enough that we sit like well after New Testament, right? So we get to look at the psalm and look at the psalmist reflecting on Genesis, but we're people that follow Jesus and we get to look at the psalmist reflecting on Genesis, but also get to look at the New Testament and reflect on Jesus himself and some of his teachings, even some of his followers and what they said about him. Because it seems to me when God created human, and like this psalm says, that he set him a little lower than the angels to rule, like everything is under their feet, these humans. This is what Jesus embodied. Like, he was the truly human one. He was the true image of God. He was able to live this in such a way that it's like you didn't have to be skeptical and wary of, yeah, but is it going to be too much power? You know, is that power going to go to his head? You know, we have that phrase, like, power corrupts, absolutely. That's what we're afraid of, right? Like, we don't want power because it's going to corrupt us. But what if? What if we had a human that could? And in fact, just because we're scared of the fact that we might fail, does it mean that it's not what we're still called to be and to do? I think even through the fear of maybe getting it wrong, there's the hope of, like, what if we got it right? Like, what if we actually got it right? I don't have these in my notes, but so we've reflected on Genesis. He would have also, the psalmist, known about a lot of people in the Old Testament, and there are some exceptional images of God in the Old Testament. None that were perfect, but some good ones. And it also paints a picture of what it means to be human in a way that's like, I almost struggle to believe. So, for example, and I'm going to use two because it's the two best ones, Abraham and Moses, right? So God comes to Abraham with a plan that he's going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham, for whatever reason, felt that it was like he was going to tell God, like, no, but what if there was 50 people there? And then he continues, like, argues with him, like, what if there's 45? What if there's 40? Right down to, like, 5. And what if there's 1? You know, like, it's basically the conversation that Abraham is having with God. That's 1. So, and he does that, and then God, all right, he listens to Abraham. Fair enough, Abraham, we'll go and save because his nephew Lot is there. You have to read the rest of the story. Similar thing happens with Moses on the mountain. Moses goes up and gets the tablets. All the people of Israel at the bottom of the mountain are, through their leadership of the priest, Aaron, sorry, not you, creating a golden calf. Like, they're creating an idol. And God tells Moses, like, I'm going to destroy him, man. Like, God's fed up. God's done. You can go read the conversation. God's done with the people. And it's Moses, the human, that confronts God and says, hang on, but then all the, your reputation will be in disrepute. Like, and he's like, and what about your loving faithfulness? Like, Moses is the one as a human pleading on behalf of his people to say, like, God, you've got to be consistent here. Like, I thought you were this way inclined. What's going on? These stories, like, and it actually says in that story, God, I think it's repented is the actual word. Like, he literally changes his mind in that story, is what you're presented with. Which, again, like, I struggle to believe it almost, but it's, you're being invited into this picture of, if you are a true image of God, you truly can mediate. Like, you can truly ask God for something, and he will actually incline his ear and do something. Which, again, like, who... I'm just a human. Like, what do you mean? I can pray and God, like, hears and sees and does. And it's like these scriptures are inviting you into this picture of, like, yeah, like, that's exactly the point. Like, you are called to rule and reign, to work and keep. Everyone in this room has their own little Garden of Eden, their own little pocket of existence. At the moment, we might not be in the full Garden of Eden, seeing the full glory of what is, but we are still in this existence that God has given us with the ability and the responsibility to work and keep, to rule and subdue. And we can do some seriously good stuff. Like, I know we're afraid of doing bad things, and we know what it looks like when human rulers can turn bad. But imagine if, like Genesis 12, like, imagine if there was a bunch of people that in one language, under one banner, hopefully the name of Jesus would be it, that we would come together and be unified, and then, like, nothing is impossible. Like, this crazy idea that, like, man, whatever we set out to achieve as a community, if we do it together under the name of Jesus, nothing's out of the realm of possibility. Like, dream as big as you want to dream. And this is really, like, the message, I guess, especially on a classic cliche sort of New Year message, I suppose. Man, make 2024 a year where it's like, I'm going to be an image of God, like a true image of God. I'm going to reflect him, like, and I'm going to be audacious enough to sort of confront God and say, God, I'm going to plead on behalf of other people, you know? I'm going to stand there and say, nah, God, I need you to do this for this person. I need you to do this for this person. Or I need you to do this in my life. Because we can. Because he actually wants us to. It's actually what he's created. He wants to partner with us. He created us as images to reflect him. He actually wants us to reflect him. It's not that he's just, like, fed up with the project or anything like that. No, this was from the very beginning. He created humans so that each one of us would individually hold something so special that is from him. But then collectively, if we came together, man, nothing's impossible. So, like I said, we need this true image. Jesus is the true image. I mean, I could pull up lots of verses, but I just went an easy one. And I went this one in particular because, honestly, just read the whole book of Hebrews and the whole image of God, Jesus being the image of God, the book of Hebrews spells it out in great detail. And it starts like this. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he also made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he provided purifications for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. And if you want to find out all about that, honestly, like I said, read the book of Hebrews, because that is the opening statement, and then it just chapter after chapter tells you he's greater than the angels, he's greater than Moses. Like, it's spelling out this whole, like, he is the one that in Genesis the humans are meant to be the image. He is that. He is that image. So then, for 2024, how do you become the image? How do we become the image of God? Because we're all different, we're all unique. It's not going to look the same for each and every one of us by any means, but we are all images. My only encouragement, and my only sort of, I could spell this out, this could be a whole other sermon about how do you be the image, but just to leave you before the start of 2024, the only really word I can give you is surrender. Because this is not about you being you. This isn't like the Disney, you're amazing as you are, do your thing. This is like Jesus is the image, and if we could all look to him, not be our own unique selves in and of ourselves, but be our own unique selves in him and what he is doing. And then if we were able to do that as individuals, but then collectively come together as we did that, man, 2024 would be a hell of a year in a good way. And I'll actually, just on that note, I'll sort of leave you with this. With this passage, really. Obviously, like I said, surrender. Galatians 2:20 says this, which is really like, this is what it means to be the image, right? I have been crucified with Christ. I no longer live. Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. That's it. Like, how do you be the image? You let Jesus be the image in you. You surrender. You get out of the way, sacrifice yourself. I mean, Jesus said the words, whoever wants to find their life will lose it. But if you want to lose your life, you'll find it. This is how do you become an image? Get out of the way. Just surrender. Surrender to him. Which, how do we do that? Well, luckily here at West City, we have a practice that we do every week. I'll invite people up for communion if you want to get ready to serve in the band. Because there is a sense of surrender. That's how you start. That's how you start to this journey of becoming the image of God. But there actually is another another thing that Jesus asks us to do or tells us to do, and that's abide in him. Abide in me and I'll abide in you. And how do you abide in him? Well, for us, as often as we can every Sunday, we take of the bread, we take of the blood, and we do it in remembrance of him. We are doing this to abide in him. We are doing this in the hope that we can proclaim his name until he comes again, and that he would actually be made real in us. And that would, like Galatians 2 says, not be us that lives individually, even collectively as a community, that it wouldn't be us, but it would be Jesus that is glorified. So, I will invite us to the table. Like that. So those that don't know, we come to the front, take a bit of bread. There is wine, there is juice, so you dip and take. And this is our invitation. So this is the table, not of the church, but of the Lord. It's made ready for those that love God and those who want to love God more. So come, you who have much faith and you who have little. You who have been here often and you who come for the first time. You who have tried to follow and you who have failed, come, because it's the Lord who invites you, and it's God's will that those who want Christ should meet him here. Let's come.
Thank you so much for joining us. Each week at West City, we say a benediction together. We do this because we believe that the purpose of the church is to be a caring community for the world, and that as we go and serve others, we enter into Christ's work of welcome, restoration and healing, both for us and others. We believe that in doing so, we get to see and encounter Christ. So let's say the benediction together. We come together as the church to be reminded of the go of Christ. So we will go out and feed the hungry, go out and clothe the naked, go out and fight for justice, go out and end oppression. Go out and proclaim anew the old, old story. Go out and associate with those who don't look like us, think like us, act like us, and don't even like us. And we'll do it all in the name of the one who sent us. His name is Jesus.